Hey everybody, this is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Robinhood.com. I know you have sat back before and wanted to get involved in the stock market. You've wanted to buy stock in Amazon, Microsoft, Google, GM, Facebook, Nike, Visa, Sony, Uber, Walmart, PayPal, Disney, Coca-Cola, GE, Apple, all of these companies that seem to be all over the place, Netflix, all of these ones, man. But you don't know how to go about it. You don't work on Wall Street. Hell, you probably don't even have a college degree. Who cares? It's the 21st century. Don't pay a commission to these losers that'll charge you 15% just to push a button from some high rise in New York City. Go to Robinhood.com today. Set up an account. It's easy as 1, 2, 3. Robinhood.com is investing for everyone. It's the easiest place to learn as you go, learn as you grow. Commission-free investing, plus the tools you need to put your money in motion. Sign up and get your first stock for free. Yeah, certain limitations apply, but that's okay. Break free from commission fees. Like I said, make unlimited commission-free trades in stocks, ETFs, and options with Robinhood Financial. And guess what? As well as buy the hottest cryptocurrencies with Robinhood Crypto. But how much is a Bitcoin today? One Bitcoin is like $33,000 regular dollars. I know you don't have that, but that's okay. Robinhood has fractional shares. You can invest in thousands of stocks and cryptocurrencies with as little as $1. Invest any amount. Choose how much you want to invest, and they will convert from dollars to parts of a whole share. Amazon costs like $3,300 for one share. Don't have $3,300 laying around? Maybe you only have $33? Well, you'll get $33 worth of a $3,300 stock. It's called a fractional share. You can build a balanced portfolio this way. You can invest in a whole wide variety of companies, and you can customize your portfolio with pieces of different companies and funds to help reduce risk. You can also trade in real time. All trades placed during market hours are executed at that time, so you'll always know the share price. You can also keep tabs on your money. You can set up a customized news and notifications to stay on top of your assets as casually or as relentlessly as you like. Controlling the flow of info is up to you. You get to manage your portfolio. You have your portfolio in your pocket, in your smartphone. Everything you need to manage your assets is available in a single app, and you don't have to deal with any loser elitist on Wall Street that isn't any smarter than the person on the corner selling bagels, but because he has a college degree, he gets to charge you money to buy and sell stocks for you? That's nonsense. It's always been nonsense, but now it's the 21st century and you have Robinhood.com, proud supporters of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Enjoy the episode. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I am your host, Chris Taylor, and today we are going to continue right down the path that we've been on, this new special series titled 12 Steps to Complete Healing, my personal journey through each step of recovery. And one thing that I failed to mention in the first three steps is this step to recovery, it's not exclusive to somebody who's suffering from addiction to drugs or alcohol or pornography or gambling or shopping or whatever, addiction in general. This step, this program is a guide to complete healing, to complete spiritual restoration, spiritual health. Addiction, after all, is in fact a spiritual ailment, spiritual disease. It is a brain disorder, but it is also a spiritual ailment. And so, though it's rooted in addiction recovery, anybody who's suffering from any level of spiritual ailments, which is all of us, right? Which is every human being. I say it a lot. We all are struggling. We all need help. We all could use some sort of healing in different aspects and facets of our life. That goes for personal, family, community, our country, and ultimately our world. So please do not think that just because you have never suffered from drug addiction or alcohol addiction that you can't benefit from these videos and this program of complete healing. So I don't know why I didn't mention that before, but it's so true. So today we are on step four, which is categorized by truth. Make a searching and fearless written moral inventory of yourself. Those of us who have worked a 12-step program or been around 12-step programs know and understand that step four is probably the most common step that people either gloss over, pretend to do, and this is when it gets really hard. And so this is when a lot of people jump off. They jump off the wagon, so to speak. Because when you do step four thoroughly and correctly, it's not easy and it's not fun. And it is very, very difficult. Especially when you have to. And so what is a searching and fearless written moral inventory? for so long. When I first got into 12-step programs when I was 18 years old, I never did this step ever in my life did I sit down and do a searching and fearless written moral inventory of myself. And what that means is that you have to go back to each stage of your life, and you have to dig deep and dive deep. And I never did it until I was in treatment after my overdose. And thankfully, the way that the VA program was set up in a way within that program was step four, without, you know, really saying, okay, this is step four. You're doing, like, it's just an assignment that was, you know, within the regular flow of the program. And I could see, okay, this is step four. They're just not saying it because, you know, 12 steps for how great they are. A lot of people, for whatever reason, get turned off when they hear that term, and a lot of it is because of step four. And so the way that they did it in my program was, you know, you had to break down the stages of your life, from your childhood to, you know, your elementary school, to your high school, to your early adult years, and all the way up to where you are now. And thankfully, I was able to do this in conjunction with a lot of other people that were doing it. Then you have to present it to them, but also working it with my personal therapist. This is where, ever since I came back from combat in 2011, all of my problems could easily be traced right to that trauma that I experienced. And I completely glossed over my whole childhood, my whole high school experiences. And that was because when you hear about people in recovery, a lot of the times they have had horrific childhoods where they've been abused and molested and, you know, just all kinds of horrific things. And that was not my childhood. That was not my life. I grew up in a wonderful, loving, religious home with two parents who loved me and taught me right from wrong and provided everything that I needed and taught me the importance of hard work and not to judge other people. And just, you know, so when people say, well, how was your childhood? I say it was great, perfect. Because it was, in all of those traditional aspects. And so when I go and I start breaking down these stages of my life, and I write some very short little things about that period and into high school, and my therapist says, well, wait a minute, why aren't you going into here? And I said, well, because I had a great childhood. I didn't, you know, I just, she said, well, okay, but let's do a searching, a fearless inventory. And some things came up that I wasn't even aware of. That I was aware of, obviously, but that I didn't know or understand that they were affecting me one bit. And the first thing was in seventh grade. Growing up playing youth soccer and little league and youth basketball, I had come to know a young kid that was my age. His name was Skyler. He was a different kid. He was unique. He was goofy. He looked different. A lot of the kids from an early age would pick on him and make fun of him and laugh at him. And as it got into junior high, it became more merciless. and more sinister, and people were, you know, it was not good. And so as a leader, as somebody that other kids looked up to, I felt a responsibility to stand up for kids like that. And I had done that from as early as I can remember, first, second grade, with different kids. And going into junior high, seventh grade, sixth, seventh grade, you know, I was a little more awkward. I was very popular, very well liked, all of that. But you know, you start to want to fit into different crowds, and you want to have an image, and you know, it became less and less cool to stand up for people like Skylar. And I did still never made fun of him. I never picked on him. I never bullied him. And on the contrary, he was on my basketball team. The 12th man, he was the last one to get picked for the team. And this is where a lot of bullying happened really, really bad. And looking back on that period, I did not do enough at all to stand up and to stop some of the more sinister things that were happening. He was in my math class, and we sat next to each other, and every day we would bring in our basketball cards. We were both basketball card collectors, and we would trade cards and you know, talk and you know, just, it was a friendship, but it wasn't like, oh, let's go hang out after school, right? Because I knew that he was an outcast, and I was not, and I was afraid, you know, if I was hanging out with him, what people would, you know, look at me. In that respect, I was a coward. And it got worse and worse and worse. And there was this one basketball card that he had that was a Manute Bull. He was real tall. He was the tallest guy to ever play in the NBA. He's from Africa. He wasn't a real popular player or anything. He wasn't a great player or anything. But he loved this card. And I think it was a lot of the reason was because Manute Bull was different than everybody else. And Skylar kind of related to that. And it got to be kind of like an inside joke between us. I would offer him the best cards, you know, in the world to trade for that card. And he would always say no. No, no, I can't trade. This is off limits, you know. And one day I would go in and I had like 10 Michael Jordan cards. And I was like, I will give you 10 Michael Jordans, 5 Charles Barkleys, all of these. I just, you know, trade me that card. And he wouldn't do it. He would not do it. And it became like a thing between us. Like, it was just a joke. Like, man, I'm going to get that card, you know. And one day we went into math class, and he seemed more subdued and depressed than normal. You could tell he, you know, something had happened, which oftentimes he would come in like that because he would just had been picked on, or made fun of or humiliated. And this wasn't just the kids. There was teachers that did this to him, very, very harshly. And, it was sickening. But that day he came in and he looked at me, and I pulled out my basketball cards, and he didn't have his, and I said, what's up, man? And he was like, he looked at me and he said, Chris, you're my friend, right? And I said, yeah. course, man, I'm your friend. And he said, I just want to thank you for being my friend. And here is this Manute Bull card. I want you to have it. And it didn't register in my mind. I said, well, okay, well, what do you mean? I said, can I give you something for it? And he said, no, I don't want anything. Just, I want you to have it. I went on about my day, went home that night, came to school that morning, the next morning, and I could see all of these people, these girls mostly, just hysterically bawling and crying. And it was like all around, and I'm walking into the courtyard with my backpack, and I'm like, what is happening? What's going on? And somebody comes and tells me that Skylar killed himself last night. It was such a gut punch. It was such a shock. As a seventh grader, how do I even look at this and process this? Knowing what I know now about suicide, giving away prized possessions is a clear red flag, and I didn't know anything about that. But over the years, I internalized that guilt, and I beat myself up so much because I was in a position that I could have done so much more to protect him, to stand up to him for him, and too many times I stayed quiet. Too many times I laughed. I can honestly say that I never did anything to you know, hurt him. I didn't bully him. I didn't pick on him. I didn't hurt him and kick him. People would punch him and kick him all the time. But I didn't do nearly, not even close to what I could have done. And I put that deep inside. And that came out in my personal moral inventory, and I was able to process it and talk about it. Some other things that came up later on in high school, I've talked a little bit about it, but at the origins of my addiction, when I got injured and I was hurt and they gave me morphine in the hospital, and later on I started using opioid pain medication for my physical injuries, to keep my spot on the football and basketball team. That was my whole focus and my whole world. And I, going into my senior year, I had major injuries and I couldn't sit out. And so that use became more and more. And then about a month before graduation, my grandmother died. She had been diagnosed with a terminal illness less than 3 or 4 months before. She was 69 years old. As an 17 year old, I thought that was old, but it's not because my dad now is 65, and I'm like, I can't imagine him dying right now, how young and vibrant he is to me. And she was really the glue that held our extended family together. Her and I were extremely close. Growing up, we were always at her house, my grandparents' house. I went to elementary school 100 yards away from her house, and we were able to get signed out for lunch every day and walk to Granny's house to eat lunch with her. And every day after school to go there and wait for my parents to get off of work. We spent the night there all the time. It was devastating. It was the first person that I had ever lost, that was my family, that I loved, that I knew and that I cared for. And all of the you know, apprehension about graduation coming up. I have an addiction developing that I'm scared. A week after that, on my 18th birthday, I get a phone call from a friend that said, "Did you hear about Matt and Carrie?" I said, "No, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, they're dead. And they died in a car crash." And the day before that, I was with Carrie, and he was a close childhood friend. I mean, we grew up from second, third grade on. Both of our parents, my dad and his dad, would coach Little League together, and we were always on the same team. Into middle school, he was on my basketball team. We were so close. I spent the night at his house all the time. His parents got divorced, and he moved away for 2 or 3 years, but then he came back at the beginning of our senior year, and we got so close again. He was an amazing pitcher. He was like 6'7", left-handed. He had like a 100 miles an hour fastball. He was kind of out of control with it, but he was so raw and talented. He had been scouted by so many different major league teams, and the major league amateur draft was coming up, and he was a shoe-in to get picked, probably in one of the later rounds, but he was going to get drafted into the major leagues, into the minor league baseball. And we had talked that weekend. I was gonna go out with them to the sand dunes. It was a popular place to go to party and to have fun. You know, it was to ride four wheelers and sand rails and you know, just have a fun time. A month before graduation, classes have kind of, you know, stopped. We're just getting ready for all of the festivities with graduation, getting everything in you know, ready for graduation and what comes next. And my grandma had just died, so I'm, you know, kind of just depressed. And I'm not able to go with them that weekend because I get in trouble and my dad grounds me. And several times before, I had been sort of a designated driver for Carrie, because he drank and I didn't drink. I did oxycodone, but you know, that was for my physical pain, and I wasn't ever like, you know, falling asleep high or nodding out or anything. I was just, you know, and so I was under control. And when I found out how they had died, you know, speeding down these roads and just being crazy and passing away, two of them, both of them, Matt was also a close friend on my football team. That was the first time that opioid pain medication that I had used to mask my physical pain, I began using it, and I realized that it could mask my emotional pain. And I suppressed all of that too. When I joined the military, you know, I pushed that all aside. I got clean and sober. I decided that I wanted to do something in my life for my country. We were at war. But that period right before graduation and then after graduation, where you know, my addiction starts spiraling big time because of these dramatic things that I don't know how to, I have no tools. I have no anything, no reference, no nothing. I just turned 18. I have lost two close friends to horrific car crash that I feel guilty for because I should have been there that night. And I realize, you know, through the processing this, that, you know, that's an unreasonable burden on my shoulders. But nonetheless, as an 18-year-old, that was a burden on my shoulders. And so I graduate, I begin spiraling. I begin using that oxycodone, and now it's a physical dependence, and now I am using it to mask my emotional pain that I have no way to process. I'm using it to mask my physical pain. I sign a letter of intent to play basketball in Iowa at a four-year university, and I'm getting ready to come up to where I have to leave and go to college away. And I am just so frightened and scared, like, what's going to happen with my addiction? I'm going to go there and withdraw. And so I call the coach and say, I'm sorry to do this, but I'm rescinding my letter of intent. My back injury is too great. I'm going to have therapy and stuff on it. And he's kind of blown away, like, okay, well, how long is that going to take? We can keep your scholarship. We can do, you know, all this. And I was just, no, just, you know, don't hold up the scholarship. Just give it to somebody else. And so then I kind of just spiral big time. For about a year and a half. And then another tragedy strikes. Another close friend that I had that I played with in basketball, that had kind of moved in as our sophomore year. And another kid that you know, he came from a broken house. His mom was not there for him. And so our athletic director brought him into his house and sort of adopted him. Not, I don't think legally, but he lived with him for sophomore, junior, and senior year. He was a standout athlete. He was an amazing guy, but because of his background and stuff, he got made fun of. And again, I didn't do anything to stand up for him, really. I probably even piled on him. But we were friends. I mean, you know, he married a very close childhood friend of mine. And you know, they got married right after high school. They had a little baby, a son, and he joined the Marine Corps. And I was so proud of him. And you know, he went off to Iraq. He was a combat engineer in the Marine Corps, a very dangerous job at that time during the 2006, when Iraq was really, the insurgency was blowing up. And he does a year-long tour. And a week before he's supposed to come home to be with his young, beautiful wife and their young infant son. Reportedly, he's on his last combat mission before he flies home. And he is blown up in an IED and he's killed. And that one hurt bad, because not only was I traumatized that he was killed, but that my friend, his young wife and child were now husbandless and fatherless. And I was there in behind the scenes with her as this was happening, before the funeral and after the funeral, and the anguish and just the war became real to me for the first time. And I looked at myself in the mirror and said, what am I doing with my life? Brandon and these, all of these people my age are sacrificing everything for the name of freedom and liberty. Coming from a long line of combat veterans, my dad was a Vietnam veteran. My grandfather served in Korea. Doing my genealogy work, I can find a male member of my family all the way back to the Revolutionary War, and have served in every conflict. And so, you know, I pull myself up and say, I can't. I'm not going to do this, man. I'm going to change my life, and I'm going to go and serve my country. And so I pushed all of this down, all of it. And then I went to combat, and experienced so much loss, so many close calls, so many of the horrors of war. When I came home, that's all that I could think about. And so it wasn't until I did this searching and fearless moral written inventory of my every stage of my life, and I was able to identify how much that early trauma had affected me, and was still affecting me. I didn't even know it. And so I was able to process it. And I was able to come to peace with it. And then I was able to now unpeel all of the things that happened to me in combat. But until you sit down and do this step four and have truth and be fearless and more and have an inventory of yourself, you can't heal. Step four is truth.